Locker Room. Welcome along. If you're new here, make sure you subscribe, like, go and watch some of the other content. It's all good, brought to you by the Tech Locker, the company that looks to protect your technology investments. Reputation. Do you know what reputation you carry? Are you sure? Is it good? Is it strong? Are you happy with it? Some people's reputation absolutely stands in front of them. Today's guest, no more so than anybody I've ever had the pleasure of working with previously, to the point where her reputation was so strong, I'll be really honest, I was a little bit intimidated before I got to meet her. But, you know, one of my favourite sayings with any of my teams is we are going to do what we say we will. And today's guest absolutely lives by those kind of values. So please welcome to the locker room, Jill Maidens. Jill, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me, Neil. It's super excited to be here. So I'm Jill Maidens. I am currently technically on a planned career break to spend lots of glorious time with my three-year-old son. But because I can't ever stop, I'm also picking up a little bit of consulting work here and there. I've been working with Redmore Health, and I believe you've had Matt Murphy, their CEO, on recently on the Tech Locker. So yeah, wonderful team to work with. I'm just doing a nice short engagement with them, but it's been absolutely fabulous so far.
Superb, superb. And that kind of balance is important. And we're going to talk about kind of balance partway through this cast as well. So what is it generally that makes you tick? I mean, you say there that you were kind of on a planned break, but you can't help yourself. You can't resist the urge. So what is it that gets you out of bed and motivates you? What makes you tick?
So I absolutely love a problem. I love getting involved, supporting like either teams, people, and just seeing where we can take that. I'm very much a fan of, I don't know if you're familiar with like the 7-day sprint, just getting in there, mapping out where we are, what's the situation, what are our options, how do we make it happen? I absolutely love that feeling. And that's what kind of drives me. So if an opportunity presents, and I can get stuck in, then I absolutely love to get stuck in. I'm also really passionate about people. So I love nothing more than working with people, bringing them together as a team. And one of my greatest achievements, I think, in my career today is taking a pretty fed up delivery team and making them into a high-performing team of individuals. And I know that term gets bandied around so much, like what is a high-performing team? But I genuinely believe that you can make any group of individuals into a high-performing team. It's just like a secret sauce to doing that. And that's all about kind of understanding what their strengths and weaknesses are and how they can equally harness those. And then layered on top of that is, well, what's our goal, what's our mission, and how does our contribution align to that of the strategic goals of the organisation? And then it's all about how we appropriately challenge each other, question each other, and be really curious with each other. And that is like magic. And I've seen that time and time again, and I feel like I've done that. I don't want to say a formula because it's different every time, because you need different elements every time. But as an approach that I take when I take on a new team or I join a new team, that's what I love to do, and that's what really makes me tick.
I think that's really important, though, isn't it, in terms of not having a kind of a single approach, because like you say, everybody's different. If you go, especially in the consulting space, you're in and out of different teams. And as soon as you go in heavy-handed and try and just do, no, it's my way or the highway, well, everyone will quite happily tell you where to go, won't they, I'm sure. But being able to kind of flex, building out that capability in a high-performing team is one thing. How have you managed to work with organisations perhaps where, while they can see the value of you delivering, you and your teams delivering, there's often a gap, and I'm sure you'll have heard that there's the IT and then there's the business, and apparently there's a massive gap in between. How have you bridged your high performance building, shaping of teams with that gap or that translation out to the business?
Keyword is curiosity in my book. So what you often find is that there isn't actually that big a gap. It's a myth, in my experience. So if everybody thinks everybody else is talking a different language, but ultimately when you peel it back, everybody just wants to do a great job. And once you can get to that level, and I can then understand as a non-technical person what your technical role is, Neil, then we start talking the same language, because then we're heading in the right direction together and we have a shared approach or a shared vision. I know that sounds really fluffy, but if you're trying to get your job done and you're seeing me as a PM constantly taking you away from your job, then I need to understand why you feel like that. But equally, you need to understand why I'm always knocking on the door. And it usually comes down to communication and curiosity around what it is you're trying to do and what it is I'm trying to do. And I think that's where it always starts. So communication, curiosity, shared alignment, and then it bridges that gap. And it, you know, doesn't work for everybody, but that's what's been successful for me.
And transparency as well, I would imagine, in terms of, you know, kind of brutal honesty. You know, it's either bad news or good news or maybe somewhere in between, but the ability to share both of those as easily and as freely, culturally, that's important to be a part of, right? Have you kind of butted heads with cultures where that's not been either appreciated or received well?
Yeah, so I would say I've definitely come across cultures where red isn't ever red, because of fear of repercussions on that. And I think, again, it comes down to your integrity as an individual and what you feel is the right thing to do. And if you come to work every day and try and do the right thing, you might not always win favour, but you can go home at the end of that day and feel like you've made your contribution to the best that you can. But yeah, transparency is really key, as is challenge. And I think a lot of issues arise at work because people don't want to challenge. When I say challenge, I don't mean going like a bull in a china shop. I mean, just feel like you can have your voice. And we get this a lot as women in tech as well, that sometimes you can be the only woman in the room. And I've had that loads of times where you're seen as almost aggressive if you challenge. But actually, what you've got to say has got meat to it. And I think my advice to anybody, certainly in junior coming into there, into the tech industry, is if you find yourself in that position, just be confident and comfortable that your contribution is valuable. And as long as it's coming from the right place, it doesn't matter if it's wrong. It doesn't matter if you haven't quite nailed it and nailed the point. The contribution is what's valuable, because it's coming from the right place.
7 minutes in, that's my soundbite right there. Absolutely. Love that. But that is very true. You know, it's ultimately is that, you know, you've used the word a couple of times, that integrity. And you know, you're standing by your values, and I introduced you in such a way that, you know, you'll always look to do what you say you're going to do. You and your teams look to do what you say you're going to do, and I think that is super important. I'm going to come back to the women in tech part as well, because I do think that's still a massive talking point. Whether or not it should be still a thing is to be debated, but I'd love to get your views on all of that. How do you define yourself? A moment ago you said, you know, if you're looking to me as a PM, how do you define yourself as a title, as a role, or as an enabler of a broader sense?
What a tricky question. I've had such a varied career. I've been really, really lucky. Predominantly I've been in the delivery space, but I have done everything from training, from customer services, to the development management and agile coaching. I've done project management, I've done program management, I've done communications, I've done PMO. And I think what I've taken from all of those roles is, again, sounds very fluffy, but I truly stand by this, is transferable skills. So every single role has been an extra thing that I can then take into the next role and build upon. So I think if you were really forced me to define myself, I would say I'm a change maker. I'm about delivery. Like that's what gets me up. I want to make a difference. I don't know if we've ever discussed this before, but I'm dyslexic, and I didn't find out I was dyslexic until I was about 34. But once I found that out, it switched everything for me, because I'd often find that I'd have to really put the effort in to get up to speed on things. And I think, why am I not retaining this information? Why do I prefer to just to get into the detail, and why do I feel I need to be in that room to hear it firsthand? And then once I got that that feedback that I was actually dyslexic in that diagnosis, it just my world opened, and I was like, oh, that's why I like to get involved. That's why I'm the one that's always asking the really awkward questions, because I need that to really get to grips with what's going on. And then that gives me a different angle. And often, as you've been in many meetings with me, Neil, I am that pain that asks all the really annoying questions. But actually, it makes people think in a different way sometimes, because you're asking almost sometimes silly questions that people haven't thought about, because you've just got like a different lens on it. And I've lost my thread. Sorry.
No. That's really good. And I have been in many meetings, and you used the word a moment ago, quite challenging of what's happening in the room. And that's perfectly appropriate in my book. And if anybody's not welcoming or supportive of a challenge, then you're in the wrong job, is also my view. But I find that quite interesting. And I think certainly over the last couple of years, the whole neurodiversity world, it's a lot more openly discussed. I think a lot more people are kind of on a similar journey to yourself, where they perhaps get to a little bit older in life, where they kind of realize that actually that's what that thing's been. Was it at the point you kind of understood that a little bit more? Was it like a weight released from you, and did it kind of give you a feeling of I don't know, greater freedom in some way?
Yeah, it did. I've always, when I was at school and at university, I felt average. And because I would work so hard, and I'd still only get a B or a C, it didn't matter what I did. I just didn't quite get. I felt like I never quite got there. I always felt like I had to put in 110% at work just to keep up. What I hadn't realised until I got the diagnosis of dyslexia is, I've actually got a lot of coping strategies in place. Like if ever I'm on a call, I'll make copious notes, because I need that, because I don't have necessarily that recall to go back. So I'm really good at note taking. Don't love it, but I'm really good at note taking. I'm really good at seeing problems from different angles, but also seeing things on a human level. So I feel like I've got high levels of empathy. I like to see things from other people's point of view. And if there's a technical problem to be solved, I'm not going to solve it for you, but I'm going to ask you loads of questions, and it's going to make you think about that solution in another way. Or as I like to call it, I'll sweep in after my husband's been trying to do something for about 45 minutes and go, "Have you thought about doing it like this?" And he'll never admit that that's what he's done. But I've just got a different way of thinking about things. And that's what I feel is my superpower now. And I'll wear that dyslexic badge with I would say almost with pride, because it makes me different. It makes me an individual, and it makes me who I am. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, there's absolutely no. And I think, I think there used to be a lot more stigma around some of these things, and it probably did all start back in school days, for certainly kind of, well, our generations. I've got a few years on you, but still back then, back when schools were hard knock and they still had the cane out, for me, there was still a stigma, I think, associated with it. But now I think there's a lot more, dare I use the word acceptance? Probably I shouldn't, but I think that is where we are.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, my dad was dyslexic, and he almost was ashamed of it. And it's interesting when I've shared this with people at work in different working environments, who are maybe a little bit older. I've had some very, very bizarre comments, like, "But you can read," or The best one. I was in a meeting, I won't say where, and I struggle with number sequence. So I might, you might say 1992, and I might write 1929. Not so good if you're doing a job where there's a lot of statistics, which is what I wouldn't say is my strength. But anyway, I was in this session, and there was somebody very senior in the session, and I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I've got those numbers the wrong way around. I'm dyslexic, it happens quite a lot." And they said, no, Gillian, that's dyscalculia, not dyslexia. And I felt very mansplained too. Sorry for the men out there. I know you're not all like that. But I corrected them on the spot. As you know, Neil, I'm not backwards and coming forwards. So I've had that. I've had another person who was well-intentioned say, oh, well done you for doing so well in your career with that burden. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's not a burden. It's an absolute superpower. It gives me a different edge. So, yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it? I do find it bizarre that those people still walk amongst us. But I think, you know, it's a bit like, you know, generations kind of getting off the treadmill, really. Things have to find a complete refresh. But, yeah, it is crazy. So you talked about the kind of challenge with numbers. I guess there are some careers that you've maybe actively steered away from, whether you wanted to or not, because of that. Is that fair or...?
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But because I hadn't found out I was dyslexic until I was 34, I've always been of the mind of I just take every opportunity I get, which when I was younger was brilliant because it's given me a really varied career. But as I've got older and a bit more mature, I've realised that actually you need to be a bit more selective about what you want to do. Not saying don't have a variety, and I'm all about like the sidestep or the pivot, however you want to say it. It's not always about going up. But you get to a certain point in your career and you can have the confidence to go, actually, that role's not quite right for me. And not jump. Whereas when I was younger, it was much more about, right, yeah, that's another step up the ladder. I'm going to be corporate. I'm going to love that world. And actually, I get to a certain level and, it's nice to be able to build and create, you know, teams or departments. And I have done that. But I'm much happier not being... I wouldn't ever consider myself, I wouldn't want to go to a C-suite, that wouldn't be me. I think there are too many constraints I would have to work within. There's too much politics in some environments, and I'm not about that. I just want to come in, get a job done and crack on. I don't necessarily want to be in the upper echelons of the exec team.
That's also very interesting, how people view that kind of top table. Yeah, you know, in some cases, and probably comes down to culture of the business you're in. In some cases, it's very much an ivory tower that's completely untouchable, and thou shalt not even look in their direction. Those are fewer and further between these days, at least. And you know, most of the modern thinking businesses are a bit more open office. Nobody even has an office. It kind of, you know, they walk amongst us, kind of thing, which is a better place to be. But I do find some of those perceptions collectively quite interesting. Your journey is an interesting one. I mean, you touched a moment ago on how you've done training, you've done coaching, you've been in PMOs, you've done all sorts of gigs. Walk us through that. How did you go from one to the other? Because you said, you know, grab every opportunity, take it for what it is in terms of a learning opportunity. How did you land where you are today, really?
Well, interestingly, I did a talk on this at Manchester Women in Tech, I think it was 2023, and that was entitled, I think it was like Corrie to COVID, which is a nice little summary of the last 20 odd years. So I haven't been in Corrie, by the way, but I when I was at high school, and I don't know if they did this when you did it, when you were at high school, but the career advice that you got at the time was somebody would come in once a month, and you might have 30 of you in a class, and this particular day she came in and she said, we're going to fill out this form, we'll put it into this computer, and it's going to tell you what careers you're suited to based on your personality traits and strengths. And this will be no surprise to you, mine came out as prison officer.
If there's a big block in this recording where an answer's laughing, that's what that was. That's fantastic. That's amazing.
So you know, at 15, slightly downbeat by that. So I thought, I don't want to be a prison officer. What do I want to do? And I thought, maybe I want to be a hairdresser. So when I did my work experience, I went off and did hairdressing for 2 weeks. Absolutely hated touching people's scalps. So that was a no for me. So I I absolutely loved, I loved English at school and I loved drama. So I actually went and did, a performing arts degree, essentially. And as part of that, there was a lot of stage management. And that was really the first kind of dip into a similar role to what I've done, because, you know, it's very dramatic working in IT. It is a bit like stage management. You know, there's lots of things going on. You've got to pull lots of divas together. Not everybody gets on. You know, you've got a deadline. There's no, you know, you get the
analogy. I've never worked with diva engineers ever. I do not know what you're talking about.
So I am. So I did my drama degree, and then I kind of left thinking, crikey, what am I going to do with this degree now? But what I knew is I loved working with people, and I got people as well. Throughout uni, I'd done loads of like customer service type roles. So I thought, I'll just do a bit of temping and see where it takes me. Ended up getting an interview for a company called EMIS Health. It was actually Egton Medical Information Systems at the time. And they were based in Leeds, just outside Leafley Road, or on Leafley Road. And the interview was interesting. I totally blagged it. A really nice chap called Nick Hillman, who I'm still in contact with now, his killer question was, can you touch type? Let me tell you, Neil, there was no typing involved in this role, or not much. And I was like, well, I did a dissertation. And he was like, yeah, sorted, in you come. And so that started kind of quite a long journey. I think initially 9 years I had with Egton and EMIS. But I started off doing what they called engineer call clearances. So an engineer goes to site, they call in, you log what they did, what parts they use, customer gets billed, etc. You'd have to take customer calls as well, like my UPS is down, that kind of jazz. So I did all that. But what I was really, really lucky to have was I had a really great line manager. Like, she was brilliant, and again, still in touch with her now. But I also, the deputy general manager, Steve Wilcock, was an absolute legend, made time for everybody and gave everybody opportunities. So when I'd been there about maybe 18 months, so all the time throughout that time, if there was like a stretch task, he'd come and offer it out, you know, to people in the team. An opportunity came up in the core business to do, it was called MOD training, and it was literally going out to garrisons and training people within the MOD, so doctors, medics. You could have anybody from a private to a brigadier in the room, and it was like classroom-based training on one of their products that had been adapted for the MOD. So this role came up. I had no experience, but my line manager, Vicky, and Steve encouraged me to go for it. So I was just like, okay, I'll go for it. You know, still bumming around, not really that bothered. I was like 23. So, yeah, so I thought I'll go for it. Went for an initial interview, and they said, right, yeah, we want to see you again, but you need to do a presentation on how you would train something. So I was like, oh, crikey, what am I going to do? Went home, had to think about it. And then I thought, we've got these like kiosks, these like little kiosks that we send our engineers out when they have to do training. I'm going to ask Steve if I can use a kiosk. So I went to Steve and said, Steve, can I use this one of these automated arrivals kiosks for my training? And he was like, well, how are you going to get it there? I was like, can I use a van? So I rocked up to my second interview with this van, with this automated arrivals kiosk, did a full training session on it and got the job. And then spent 18 months to two years as a training exec, and then eventually an operations manager. Just traveling around the country, basically delivering this training, and that gave me the first kind of real kick that actually, if you put the effort in, the rewards are there, and you can have quite a fulfilling, interesting career. And, you know, I didn't know anything about training when I started, but by the end of it, you know, I'd gained a load more skills. And that's where the curiosity started, and that's where I kind of thought, right, I've just got to grab every opportunity that I can here. So then another opportunity arose, which was like for the central training team. So the training and implementation team, as they called it. And again, applied for that, got that, worked there for a while. And that brought in kind of the project program management element of it, because we were part of the team that kind of got the core platform, which was EMIS Web at the time, for accreditation with NHS Digital, as it was then known. So did that. Then I moved into, and there was another opportunity in to work and move in the comms team. So did that. And then I was in the comms team, and I'd spent quite a lot of time with the then development managers of the department. So the comms teams at the time, they called it a comms team, but I guess it was trying to fulfill what was a PMO, but they didn't really have a PMO notion at that point because they didn't have a big team of PMs. So we did a bit of everything. We did all the reporting as you would in a PMO. We did all the resourcing as you would in a PMO, but we just called it a comms team. But I was working side by side with these development managers and picked up loads of stuff from them. And then one of them left, kind of out of the blue, I was asked, "We think you could do that role. Do you want to do it?" So I was just like, okay. I've not really run a technical team before. Do you think I can do it? I took the leap, and the first 3 weeks weren't amazing because the tech team, the devs, can you imagine what they thought? This girl that's just come from comms, doesn't know anything about tech, what the hell is she doing? It was a massive learning curve for me in how to work with people and get on the same level of them. And it comes back to what we started at the front, Neil, being curious and trying to understand people's roles and what their mission is and what they're trying to contribute. And what I very quickly learned was they don't need a non-technical person trying to give them technical hints and tips, which I would never have tried to do anywhere. They need to see that I'm going to advocate for them as a leader and that I'm going to support them and give the freedom and the trust to get on with their job. I'm going to keep the noise at bay so they can focus and to cover the kind of technical side of it. I had a technical lead in my team and we worked as a team. So he did report into me, but we didn't treat it like that. We treated it like a partnership and it worked beautifully. And then what I also did was I almost did like a feedback for me session. So they all got a feedback form that they filled in anonymously, sent through the tech lead to me about what they thought I could improve upon. And I made a really conscious effort over the next kind of 6 months to improve on all of those things, like learn a bit more about, branches and pipelines, learn a bit more about why it takes so long to build and compile, learn a bit more about pair programming. I did all of that stuff. And when they could see that I said I was going to do it, I listened to the feedback and I developed on that. I got so much respect for that. And then when I eventually got poached to move as a development manager in another company, they were actually quite gutted. And that was like, to me, that was like my first experience of really developing a team and being part of something quite special. But again, it comes back to, listening, that curiosity and that growth, all of which are like part of my core values. And I just didn't really know them as core values at that point.
It makes the hard slog worth it though, doesn't it? When that's kind of the outcome, when ultimately if you're missed, as soon as you step away and people are going, "No, please stay," it kind of makes all the hard work that little bit more worth it.
Yeah, and I think it was then that I kind of realised as well that there's a benefit to having experience on both sides of the coin, so on the tech side and on the non-tech side, because you can be a really, really good development manager, but you might not have any kind of commercial understanding. You might not have any kind of understanding of why deadlines need to be met, what it is like to deal with customers, and the impact it can have when deadlines are not met from a business and commercial point of view. But equally, you can be on the delivery side and not understand why things slip, why technical issues come up at the last minute, why things go wrong, and why delays happen. And I feel privileged to have been able to see it from both points of view. And it definitely changed my thinking and my perception and my approach going forward. And it's how I think that's what I've built upon in the last few years, for sure.
So do you consider yourself, perhaps not now, but certainly at that time, did you consider yourself a non-techie techie? Or are you now just, do you stay in the non-technical camp? Are you happy to declare yourself techie? Where are you at?
No, I wouldn't say I'm a techie. I think I'm a curious non-techie. So I will, for years, before I had my son, I would go to tech meetups, and I'd quite often be the only person that was a project manager by trade in those meetings, because I'm interested. I was reading earlier in the year about robotic process automation, just because I was interested. Maybe I'm a geek and I just don't know it. I don't know. But yeah, if I'm interested or if I need to learn something, I will go off and I'll put the effort in to learn it. Since having a baby, I have got immense brain fog. So I wouldn't say that I could still write, a bit of EB6, which was a challenge from the team. And I did do it at the time, but I couldn't do it now.
I think there's a frustrated engineer somewhere in there, isn't there? Really? I mean, that is quite the journey. There's a few important messages in there in terms of, take those opportunities, go learn, absolutely on the listen front. I think we are way past in the technical world. We are way past that kind of them and us. I mean, there used to be a point where developers and testers would never talk to each other. They hated each other. That's no longer a thing pretty much across the board, and that's all good. And I think the same is true with people like you outlined. You're there to help, you're there to facilitate and enable and help them do what they do. But you use the words like trust and respect, and I think that's key. And if you can really build that, it doesn't really matter what your title is and all the rest of it. One question that did arise as you were talking there was you were talking about how you had to really kind of graft, almost to prove yourself to the team to kind of earn that respect and show that you were there with them and for them. Did you feel that you had to work harder in that time because you were non-techie, because you were a woman in tech, or maybe a combination of both?
I think it was larger because I was a non-techie. I think it's a tricky one. I think I've been quite privileged in my career that I've never felt a massive disadvantage in being a woman. I've almost felt like I was leading the edge there and that I was championing the way for other women. So I haven't felt necessarily barriers in terms of progression or acceptance. I have on occasion had situations where I've been an expert in a room on a given subject and I've had male counterparts completely disregard my opinion because what could I possibly know, even though my opinion's based in fact and grounded by statistics. I've had that before. But it's about advocating for yourself. And I appreciate that not everybody can do that. And I, have absolute massive bouts of imposter syndrome. But I do, it's like what I said at the start. There's no wrong answer as long as the information that you're sharing or the point you're raising comes from the right place. And if you keep that in mind, then you shouldn't let that stop you from contributing. But yeah, I've been really lucky. I know there's a term now that people use like allyship. And I feel like I've had quite a lot of that throughout my career, with like this, I mentioned Steve Wilcock. There's been others along my career, yourself for one, always made a lot of time for me when I was at EMIS, just to get different perspectives. I've had loads of that and I've been really fortunate. But of course I've had like other people say, she's plateaued, she's at a limit or whatever, without really getting to know me. And maybe that is that creeping in, you know, she's a woman or whatever. But I haven't personally felt it's been a huge blocker. And I'm from a period of time where in tech, when I did my first PM job, there was no women that walked into development, and developers literally used to walk out of the room into the canteen when me and a colleague walked in, because it was that uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it's well, I can't imagine it's a nice place to exist at all. Has that in any way tinged your lack of desire to push on to the C-suite, because of typically the C table still really largely to this day being fundamentally a middle-aged white male, not as much, but still to a degree?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I think I'm not very good at the gameplay, and I think you do need to be able to do that. I think there's a little bit of imposter syndrome there as well. Like, what could I possibly have to contribute? Which is bonkers, because, you know, I've had an absolutely massively varied career and covered lots of different areas. But yeah, I think maybe a little bit. I've definitely found it as I've got more senior, it is a rougher game, and you've got to be happy playing that. And maybe 10 years ago I would have been happy to get stuck in, but now I'm just about, you know, a happy life, not a stressful life, and that's why I'm trying to craft the kind of life that I want, rather than just strive for something that I think I should go for, because it's the next logical step. I'm not saying never, but for right now it's not anywhere near where I want to go.
So that's almost a podcast in its own right, is to whether you should take something because it's the next step on the ladder, kind of like your career's person at school, you know, it's the thing you should do next, or whether it's the thing you actually want to do. And then, you know, a lot of people are very content staying as hands-on engineers all the way through the career and not seeking any kind of promotion. So I think mm-hmm. you're right there. It's very much about you as an individual and your career over and above what society or politics or the rule book says you should do next. So I think that's a good call out. But that was a beautiful segue into the next question. It's almost like you can see my cards here, about that balance, you know, and building the life and the balance of life that you want. As you said, you've got a young family, and so it's probably the focus shifts. Like, yeah, when you're younger in your career, you charge at things, you work 27 hours a day and do all those silly things that we've all done, but now you're a mum, you're a wife, you have a family, you want that balance in things. How do you build that? And as a mum returning to the workspace, what was your strategy and thinking of, was there any pressure around, I'm going to have to work extra hard now because I've been out and people are going to think I've lost a yard of pace? There's a lot in that, but, you know, make something of all of those questions. And how have you found that balancing?
So when I found out I was pregnant, I remember talking to my boss at the time. He was really supportive, by the way. And I was like, yeah, I'll probably be back 5 days a week. Maybe I'll do five over four. Like, you won't even know I'm gone. Like, I'm already, like, trying to say to my husband, you know, make sure I stay off for a year. Like, I know I'm going to be itchy after 6 months. I want to go back, just because that's how I've always been. But I can honestly tell you now, the minute that baby came out, I changed as a person beyond what I ever could have imagined I would change. And all of a sudden, like, work, like, still important. It pays the bills. I get a kick out of it. But it wasn't as important as this little dot that I was, like, holding. So, yeah, so when I actually came to go back to work, I was like, there's no way I can put this person into, well, I call him a person, Oscar, into nursery 5 days a week. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It just wasn't right for me. And I know some women do it. Some women don't have a choice. I was very fortunate that I did have that choice. And I was really supported by my company to go back on 3 days a week. So I did three long days, 3 10-hour days. But I was different. I had brain fog. He barely slept. I was extremely tired all the time. All these things that I'd never had to deal with before. My magic time of the day before having children was like 6 till 9. I could block out a whole, kick out a whole day's work, 6 till 9, because that's my sweet spot for focus. You know, I was lucky if I wasn't already up at 4 o'clock in the morning when I started back at work, because Oscar just did not sleep. Some nights I slept in the cot with Oscar because he did not sleep. So then having to go into a board meeting the next day and perform at the level that I'm used to performing, I found like it was a shock to the system. And I don't think we talk about it enough. We talk about, you know, mums want it all and you can have it all. And I think we don't put enough focus on, well, actually, not everybody can. I felt immense guilt. I either felt like I wasn't giving 100% to work or I wasn't giving 100% to Oscar. And that really, that was like the biggest eye opener for me. And I was largely unhappy. And you know, that's nothing to do with work itself. It's just I couldn't find that balance and something was missing. And I felt like I wasn't the old me, but I was never going to be the old me because my world had completely changed and my responsibilities had completely changed. And like you said, you can't do a 27-hour day anymore because you've got other commitments and other responsibilities. And actually, if your son's not going to sleep, you know it's going to be that night when you've got that massive presentation the next day. You just know it is.
Yeah.
If he's going to be poorly, it's going to be when you've got that big report due. It just is like that. That's the way of the world. I thought before he would just slot nicely into my life. I hadn't realised that I would change so fundamentally as a person that I'd really start to question what I wanted out of work and what I needed out of work. And again, I'm very privileged in that I had the means to get an exec coach. So I got a coach and thought, I just need a thinking partner here. And I had a few sessions with her and it made me realise that what actually was missing is, because I was doing the long days, because I was on a really high-profile programme, I could never really give my full dedication to one thing or another. So when I was with Oscar, I was with him, but I wasn't with him. I was thinking, I've got that to prepare. I've got that meeting to sort out. On Monday, what will I go back to? Blah, 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 blah. And when I was at work, I was thinking, what if Oscar doesn't sleep tonight? I'm not going to get time to do this presentation unless I stay up till 12 o'clock. And it was just constant back and forwards. And that also meant that I didn't have what I need to fulfill me in terms of that connection, because, you know, pre-COVID, you were in the office, you were around your team, the team that you work with day in and day out. And yeah, sure, you can go into the office as a remote worker now. You might see 2 or 3 people, or you might see 100 people, but none of them might be your team because your team are all over the place. And it's just not the same. Now, I'm totally an advocate for home working, for flexible working. I'm not saying we should all be back in the office at all. And I think it's really antiquated for anybody that thinks that. But that's their choice. But I needed that connection, and working at the pace that I was working, working the hours that I was working, every call I had with somebody was transactional. There was no, how are you? Let's, you know, how are the kids? And I thrive on that as a person. You know, when I was a line manager, I made it my mission that if you told me at the start of the year that your child was going to be, I don't know, in a play in June, that I'd make sure I'd come back in June and go, how's the play? Because I like that. I think it makes a big difference to a team and as a leader, and that's what you should be doing. And I suddenly couldn't fulfill any of that. I couldn't grow because I didn't feel like I had enough time, either in my home life or at work, to develop, read anything. I wasn't looking after myself. So anyway, I did a lot of work with this exec coach, and she said, right, we really need to think about your values. And as soon as I started to think about my values what that meant for me and what I needed in order to fill those values, I knew I needed to think about a change to my life, a fundamental change. And fortunately for me, the business that I was in at the time were acquired, and I took the opportunity to take a year off at that point. But as we've touched on at the start, that year didn't last a year because I got another opportunity, but one that aligned to my values and fits into what I've now called my boundaries. So, you know, I'm not willing to work a really high profile job. I'll do a really good job, but I want to do small engagements. I want to do things that I'm passionate about and that I can really make a difference in, rather than just any job that brings money in. Now, you know, again, I understand totally that I'm in a very, very privileged position and not everybody can do that. So I guess to go back to your question at the top, which is what strategies could other people employ? I think number one is really make sure that you stay in touch with your company when you go on that leave. Make sure you use those kit days. Make sure you have a really good think about the kind of role you want to go back into and have that dialogue with your organisation. I mean, as I said, I was really fortunate. I did have that dialogue with my company, and they were really supportive in that. Don't be afraid to ask for help or say you're struggling, because, you know, your world has changed. You're operating on minimal sleep sometimes, and you might not be able to work at the best time that suits you anymore, because it's just the way that your work life has panned out. I would say make sure you don't forget about your needs, and that could be as simple as getting 10 minutes out a day to walk around the block when you're on a conference call, because I let all that slide, and that was a really big mistake. And think about your values. It doesn't take long to sit down and have a think about your values and really question, are you getting what you need from the role that you're doing? And if you're not, it's not always about leaving, because not everybody can, but have that conversation with your line manager. There might be other opportunities that you can either be stretched into or be given exposure to give you that fulfillment. So that's what I would say.
Wow. I mean, you kind of said right at the start of that section there around it's not something that's discussed broadly enough or in any way at all in terms of the impact that can have. And some, you know, really, really good, clear guidance there. As you were talking, though, I think one thing that was in my head was all your advice there, which was superb, and I was making note of the time for the sound bites. But as you were talking through that, it was all very much aimed at mum, at the person in question here, which is still kind of letting the businesses off in my mind, in terms of, you know, you weren't actively doing this, but it's still the pressure or the onus is on, you know, the likes of yourself coming back to the workplace and you having to make the compromise to find the balance, to adjust, to not let things slide. The pressure is still very much on you as a new mum in that sense. And the businesses still have seemingly no real kind of pointed finger at them. So if you were going to offer one thing out to them by way of and as a business, please make sure you do, what would that be?
I think there are a couple of things, actually. I hope you don't mind. I think the first thing is be supportive of employee flexible working requests. Now, my company were, and I was really fortunate, but that makes a big difference. And for a lot of mums that I speak to, their concern is, am I going to be able to get childcare around when I can work, and what does that mean for me? Because the concern is you can't go back into a big role because you won't be able to make it work on the hours that you do. Now, some people can, some people can't, but actually, if you can't and you can't make it work, don't get hung up on that. It's for a period of time in your life, and actually it might be the best decision you ever make. And then the other advice to a company would be, there's loads of really good organisations out there that can help you shape your policies and HR policies and provide support ongoing for your employees. And a few that spring to mind. So there's a great piece of work done by a company called Careers After Babies. I don't know if you've heard of them, but wonderful, wonderful company. Did loads of research on what it's like for women when they return from work in a senior role, and they now offer guidelines, so you can be on their registry if you like, and they'll talk to you about policy, what you can put in place, and then there's another company called the Springback Guide, and they offer coaching and support for women coming back in from maternity and other career breaks. I think they call they've got a trademark hashtag Returnity, which I think is brilliant. Yeah, so there's loads in that space, and I think any company worth their mustard should really be thinking about that kind of Returnity package, or I won't say Returnity, actually it's trademark, that return package for their employees. There's loads of them out there. So that would be my guidance. The other thing that nobody ever talks about, Neil, although it's starting to get a little bit more coverage, is what can they do for the dads? Because actually, you know, 50% of the population ish, they're dads. And you know, when I had my baby, my husband was really fortunate. I think he had 2 weeks paternity, but then he added like 3 weeks on top of that. Now I had a C-section, emergency C-section, so that didn't really touch the amount of support I needed. But you know, other people don't have that ability to add on 3 weeks. And I know it's more popular now, or it's becoming more prevalent that companies are giving longer periods of paternity. But I also think there's something there about helping dads adjust and offering additional support, because they're also getting sleepless nights and they've also had the life-changing event. So it's just that, basically.
I've written a whole bunch of stuff down. That was super. All of the links you mentioned there, when I publish this, I'll put them in the notes to the video so people can go and look those up. I wasn't aware of any of those. So every day is a school day. That's fantastic. I love that hashtag, which we won't say because it's trademarked. But that's absolutely superb. And you're right about the dads. Although I would point out that dads, if you are watching and you're not playing your part, then play your part, because then you can absolutely take part in that debate. Fabulous, absolutely superb. Summer holiday time. Well, for some, maybe not for all. But school holidays, so all the kids are off, and people typically take themselves away. If after watching this, of which there will be millions of viewers, clearly, Jill, I'm up there with some of the best, obviously. But for everybody watching this and listening to your advice, what would you like them to go and sit on that sun lounger, hopefully by the pool, nice bit of chill time? What's the takeaway that you're hoping people do take away?
Okay, so I think, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, key to it is curiosity. So make sure you stay curious. You can't go far wrong with being curious about other people, about what you want out of life. To aid that curiosity, I think reflection is key, because until you stop and reflect and take time for yourself, you're not gonna know what's next for you and what's right for you. I think I've got so many key takeaways, Neil. I'm just going to end up repeating the podcast, but put effort into understanding what your values and your drivers are, because that really, really should guide you in life. And I don't think you go far wrong.
Perfect. All right. Last couple of minutes, couple of quick fire questions. These are usually the ones people find the hardest, oddly. Biggest influence on your career?
I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. The biggest influence on my career was working with that technical team as a non-technical leader, because it taught me so much about myself and how to make a good team and make a team thrive. And it changed my perspective. So, yeah, that.
Nice. Hardest lesson?
Hardest lesson, I think, is... don't jump for salary. Don't be led by a salary. Make sure you understand what you're going to get out of that role and what value it's going to add to you as a person and your career ultimately.
Nice. So my next question was going to be advice for younger Jill. If you could go back and whisper in your own ear, would that answer carry, or have you got other advice?
I think advice to younger Jill would be, don't go in as hard. So when I was young and first starting out my career, maybe this comes back to quite often being the female in the room, I'd stand my ground and I wasn't flexible. Whereas now I try to hear, like, I think it's Kobe that said it, wasn't it? Like, listen before you speak. So I try to hear what other people are saying before I just dive straight in. And I try not to shoot from the hip quite so much and just think about what I'm going to say. So I think, yeah, my advice would be, you know, take a breath.
Take a breath. I think we could all learn from that one. And you are in the locker room. So the one question we always end up with everyone is, what is in your personal locker that has made you the success that you are?
I think, being empathetic to others, like understanding people is the best thing you can do. I know I've mentioned curiosity like a million times in this pod, but honestly, curiosity applies to so much. Like, you can understand people, you can work anywhere and you can work with anyone. It's like one of the best transferable skills.
Love it. Absolutely love it. That's the end. Jill, thank you so much for coming on. Really, really enjoyed that one. There's a bazillion things that I'm going to need to pull out and tease the audience with in terms of sound bites on that one. Really, really good takeaways. Lots for people to digest, to consider. Really honest sort of thought process and transparency and how you've got to where you are, which I think will help a lot of people. So thank you very much for all of that. For those watching, make sure you like and subscribe to keep up to date with this cast and all of the ones subsequently. You can watch us on YouTube, you can listen to us on Spotify, so go and like and subscribe. And when we reach 100 subscribers, for every 100 we plant a tree, so do your bit for the green things too. Leave some comments. Thanks again to the fabulous Jill Maidens. In the meantime, everyone take care. We'll see you again next time in the locker room. We'll be right back.